Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Richard Clark, the CEO of Good Harbor Security Risk Management, which advises companies and governments on cybersecurity. He served for 30 years in the U.S. government, including 10 continuous years as a White House official, serving three consecutive presidents as special assistant to the president for global affairs, national coordinator for security and counterterrorism, and special advisor to the president for cyberspace. The author of 8 books, including the New York Times number one bestseller, Against All Enemies, Inside America's War on Terror. His most recent book is Warnings, Finding Cassandras to Prevent Catastrophes. And he is the host of a new podcast, Future State. Welcome to Background Briefing, Richard Clark.
Oh, good to be with you.
And Richard Clark, since you've served in three administrations, both Democratic and Republican, and been a professional on the National Security Council, both in terms of counterterrorism and cybersecurity, if you were in the Trump White House today, would you have written that op-ed piece in the New York Times that's caused so much controversy?
No, I wouldn't. You know, I think two observations. First, it is natural for career civil servants to resist the whims of presidents and to try to slow roll some of their initiatives. That's natural. It's unusual for political appointees to do that. Second observation is there comes a time when you have to quit and go public with your concerns. If you're ordered to do something that's illegal, if you're ordered to do something that's immoral, then I think you have an obligation to quit. But you have to remember that everybody takes an oath before they can serve, and it's an oath not to the president, but to the Constitution. And so when you're being told to do things that would damage the country, I think it's a natural reaction to not do them.
So you mentioned that in terms of setting up this new podcast that you're hosting starting today, Future State, and I take it it's a continuum of the idea that you were a sort of sentinel in your job on the National Security Council to look ahead. And that's why 9/11 was so important, in the sense that some people predicted it and others ignored that information. But in saying that we need to be focusing on cyber war, terrorism, nuclear weapons, climate change, and the future of work in America in this election year or these election months, you're suggesting that we shouldn't get lost in the Trump show. Just talking about the op-ed, in a sense, in the New York Times is getting lost in the Trump show, in as much as what's happened is, with Trump basically conducting what I call government by stunt on a daily basis, the press is not focusing on the contents of that op-ed, but rather on who possibly wrote it.
That's right. And what I'm trying to do with the Future State podcast is not talk about what you're seeing on the cable news, but talk about issues that people should be thinking about and should be discussing. What is the future of work? What is the risk, continuing risk, if there is one, of terrorism? Why are we about to spend $1 trillion on new nuclear weapons? What's the risk of climate change? Those are things that you would normally talk about. You'd look forward at the new risks, the new threats. You'd want candidates to talk about that sort of thing under normal circumstances. And the Trump show drowns all of that out. I'm not saying don't talk about Trump, because we have to. We have to get rid of this guy somehow. So we do have to talk about him. But it shouldn't be the only thing we talk about. We still have to worry about the substance, about the issues.
So what worries me is that we don't know what went on in that secret meeting between Trump and Putin in Helsinki. We certainly saw the aftermath at the press conference, where the president of the United States, in front of the eyes of the world, essentially sided with Putin over whether he meddled in our elections. He, of course, denied it, and Trump basically accepted that denial in front of the cameras, and then later had that kind of lame, you know, my dog ate my homework excuse that I meant to say wouldn't or would have, you know. So we don't know what went on prior to that press conference. The press conference itself was alarming enough. And frankly, I think John Brennan is correct in suggesting that there may have been a line crossed there in terms of treason, because on January the 6th of 2017, a couple of weeks before Trump was inaugurated, all the heads of intelligence briefed him and gave him absolutely unequivocal information about the extent of Russian interference in our elections, and yet he chose to ignore that. Any commander-in-chief in that situation in our history would have turned to Putin and said, yes, you did it, and don't do it again. So let's focus on that for a minute. Do you think this president could be engaged in some kind of treasonous activity short of the traditional legal definition of treason?
Well, I don't know what was said. That's the problem. None of us know what was said. Some people have suggested to me that maybe that was a way of him, a way of Trump getting new orders, getting his orders updated, getting new guidance from the boss. Problem is, we don't know. And so rumors like that and assumptions like that are allowed to propagate. And they're terrible rumors and terrible assumptions, but we have no way of knowing whether or not they're true. I think if you look at the Steele dossier, that the British intelligence officer who, during the 2016 election, put together all of this information about Trump and Russia, 99% of that has been corroborated. And that's very disturbing. I think there is something that the Russians have on Trump. I think it probably has to do with money laundering through his company. I'm hoping Bob Mueller will find that and prove it.
Well, but without being paranoid or indulging in conspiracy theories, the fact that that was a secret meeting leads to the, I think, the very real possibility that since Putin interfered in the last election to elect Trump or help elect him, it's not inconceivable that we know that Trump is really paranoid about the Democrats taking the House.
And for good reason.
For good reason, because then they start investigating, which is really what's, I think, the crying shame of what's happening to the United States at the moment, that we don't have a separation of powers, because the legislative branch is not acting as a check and balance on the executive branch, and that will certainly happen if the Democrats take the House. But to my mind, it's not inconceivable that in that private meeting, Trump said, look, you helped me out in 2016, but I really need your help, Vladimir, in November, because this Democratic blue wave is going to probably sweep the Republicans out of the House, and then they'll start investigating me and they'll impeach me. So
I don't think Trump even has to ask for the Russians' help. I think they know that this situation is occurring, and we know for a fact that many of the troll identities that they were using in 2016 are back. You know, they change, they go on Twitter, and they change the name that they're using. But you can still tell it's the same source. And we know they're active. And they're doing a whole series of things to cause division in our country. They're pretending to be African Americans and saying blacks should not vote. They're pretending to be environmentalists. And they're saying people should vote for the Green Party. It's not a wasted vote, you know, even though it obviously is. They're assuming all sorts of different identities, not just to promote Republicans, not just to promote Trump and his allies, but also just to whip up hate and dissension here in the United States.
Well, but you also could be describing Fox News in a sense, because the Russians call them political technologist, but this character Surkov, a theater director who became Putin's media advisor and has basically created this alternative universe where facts don't matter, that nothing is true and everything is possible, that's sort of migrated here to the United States. And if 30% of the country wasn't locked inside the bubble of delusion that Fox and Breitbart and Sinclair propagate, Trump would, I think that would be, he'd be on his way out totally, as opposed to hanging on and pandering to that constituency. So do you see any similarities there in this Orwellian sense that we have You know, when you got people like Kellyanne Conway, the White House counsel, talking about alternative facts.
But you see these themes pop up, and they're picked up by Fox News. They're picked up by Breitbart. They're also picked up by the Russian outlets like RT and Sputnik. And they're picked up by all the Russian troll identities. And it's difficult to know from one theme to another where they first appeared, because they have a remarkable tendency to appear simultaneously, it seems, on both the Russian outlets, the Russian trolls and fake identities, and Fox News and Breitbart all at the same time.
And again, I'm speaking with Richard Clark, CEO of Good Harbor Security Risk Management, which advises companies and governments on cybersecurity. He served for 30 years in the United States government, including 10 continuous years as a White House official, serving three consecutive presidents, a special assistant to the president for global affairs, national coordinator for security and counterterrorism, and special advisor to the president for cyberspace. The author of 8 books, including the New York Times number one bestseller Against All Enemies, Inside America's War on Terror. His most recent book is Warnings, Finding Cassandras to Prevent Catastrophes. And he's the host of the new podcast, Future State. But in your previous job, after you was head of counterintelligence on the National Security Council, Richard Clark, you became the cyber czar, for the want of a better description. Back to that question, though, we don't know what went on in that secret meeting in Helsinki between Putin and Trump, but we do know that the Russians made explorations in the last election cycle in 2016 into voting rolls and into state election systems, many of which aren't secure at all, particularly in Georgia, where you have a Secretary of State who himself doesn't appear to believe in democracy and is quite capable of rigging the results on these electronic machines, which he did in terms of the John Ossoff race down there in that first important special election that could have been a bellwether for Trump's support. What's your understanding of how vulnerable we are to either election rolls being hacked or the results themselves in this midterm being hacked?
Well, you have three different things that can be hacked. You have the campaign organizations themselves. Some of them are independent, some of them are party organizations, but they're notoriously vulnerable because they just don't have enough money for cybersecurity. It turns out really securing a network is expensive. The second thing you have that can be hacked are the voting rolls, so that when someone shows up to vote, they're not on the list, or they have to go to another location. And many of those people will just say, to hell with it. At that point, or it'll make the lines very long in certain locations. If you know the Democrats are going to do well in that precinct, you make the lines very long there, and people will eventually go home if they're having to stand out in the rain. The third thing that you can hack, of course, are the machines themselves, and that turns out to be notoriously easy if you have access. Now, getting the access is difficult. But there are three different things. And what we've learned is the Russians have tried to do hacking into campaigns, succeeded in the case of the Clintons. They've tried to hack into the voting lists. We don't know that they have tried to go after the machines, but here's the thing that I would point out. We don't know the extent of what they've done. We only know what people have caught. And most of the time when a Russian state organization tries to hack into something, they do it so well that they don't get caught. So when people say, oh, there's no evidence that this happened, yeah, well, of course not. There wouldn't be evidence because they're really good at it. When the United States government does it, there's no evidence.
Well, conversely, of course, the Skripal attack with Novichok in Salisbury in the UK looked as though, with the GRU's fingerprints on it, that Putin was actually sending a signal that he wanted to get caught.
In that case, absolutely. That was about deterrence. Right. That was a message to anybody who's thinking about, any Russian who's thinking about being a spy for the West, That was the message. We have a long arm. Wherever you are, we'll get you and we'll kill you.
So tell me about the new podcast. Your first guest is Bill Clinton. That's today, right?
The first one is, there are two available today. One is with Bill Clinton. The second one, which we did for 9/11, is with the former head of the National Counterterrorism Center, Nick Rasmussen. Mm-hmm. And Michael Sheehan, who was held five or six prominent counterterrorism jobs in the White House, the Pentagon, the State Department. After we taped that, Michael Sheehan died. He'd been fighting a cancer, and this was his last interview. And it's a very powerful interview. It talks about the fact that the terrorism threat is moribund, but not yet completely removed, and it could come back. And we're not saying it will come back. We're not trying to scare people. I think it's a very level-headed discussion for about an hour. But it sounds like the three counterterrorism people talking in a way that it sounds like you're in a room in the White House listening to them. It doesn't sound like an interview. It doesn't sound like something that was meant to be public. It sounds like three professionals talking about the issue.
And in terms of terrorism, though, I would link it in a way to going back to Putin. I don't mean to obsess on him, and I get lots of letters from listeners saying that I'm obsessed with Russia, but I don't believe there's ever been anything like this. The very possibility that the President of the United States could be an asset of the leader in the Kremlin is the most extraordinary, if it's true, it'd be the most extraordinary intelligence operation since the Germans put Lenin in a boxcar in 1917 and sent him to Russia. So that's my justification for keeping an eye on Putin. But I see a link here in terms of what's happening in Western Europe, where one or two terrorist acts can change elections, as we've just seen in Sweden. Last time when Putin intervened in Syria, shortly thereafter was the major exodus of refugees into Europe. Now they have Idlib surrounded and they're about to pound that place into submission. 3 million refugees could flood into Turkey and on into Europe. And last time it happened, the SACEUR, the Supreme Allied Commander in Europe, referred to what Putin was doing as was weaponizing refugees. So that seems to me to be a strategy that he's used and he may use again to weaken Western Europe. What's our strategy?
Well, we don't have one. The United States is not a player in what's going on in Turkey, in Syria. You know, we still have 2,000 troops in and around Syria. But if you look at the last two diplomatic conferences, summits, the president of Russia, the president of Turkey, the president of Iran, they're the ones who are sitting around the table deciding what's going to happen. There's no American at that table.
So how are we going to get through then this period where you have this almost theater of the absurd with President Trump? He's swapping kind of love letters via tweet with Kim Jong-un. He had this absolutely fatuous and meaningless photo op down in Singapore. It's obvious that it's going nowhere. He wants to meet with Putin. None of the real stuff's being dealt with. Where are these so-called adults in the room? Are they just not in a position that we've never had a situation before where we have a president who himself is very likely to be a threat to America's national security?
This reminds me of the period when Richard Nixon was on the ropes, the last days of Richard Nixon, when he was hitting the bottle, his alcoholism was rampant, and his Secretary of State, Henry Kissinger, and the Secretary of Defense, Jim Schlesinger, were running the national security show, including the Middle East war that was going on in 1973, essentially without talking to the president, because they were afraid to. I don't think we've had anything like it in my lifetime, except for that. It's almost the Manchurian Candidate, if you saw the original movie, where the leader could, in fact, be under control, could be a controlled asset of a foreign government. I don't know that that's true, but I think it's a reasonable suspicion. And that's pretty awful.
Right, but the difference with Nixon was he was probably one of the most competent presidents we've ever had and most experienced.
When he was sober and when his paranoia was under control.
Right, but in terms of foreign policy, it's true. He was having a bad day when Watergate was happening. But this guy, out of the gate, he has no qualifications. He has no understanding. Woodward's book indicates that Secretary of Defense Mattis feels it's like talking to a fifth or sixth grader.
Well, so Mattis and, to some extent, Pompeo, now at State, try to maneuver around him. It's not so much that they're disobeying orders. It's that they're doing things without reference to him, and they're hiding things from him. But there is no national security process. I was always big on process, that issues should be identified, issues should be analyzed, evidence should be presented, options should be created, options should be compared one to the other, and then the president should have the benefit of all of that, transparent process. None of that happens now.
Well, just in closing, I don't want to depress our audience. I certainly, myself, on a daily basis, I feel I'm dispensing the daily dose of doom, just covering Donald Trump. Is there any light at the end of the tunnel?
Yeah, I think there is. And I felt very, watching the John McCain memorial at National Cathedral, I felt uplifted. That the church was filled with great Americans, all of whom want to have nothing to do with Donald Trump. And people talked about what this country has been, what this country is, what this country can be again. I think this could be a passing disaster, like a hurricane going through a city. I hope that's the case. But for that to be the case, people have to get out and vote in November.
Well, on that note, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Richard Clark.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Richard Clark, CEO of Good Harbor Security Risk Management, which advises companies and governments on cybersecurity. He served for 30 years in the United States government, including 10 continuous years as a White House official, serving three consecutive presidents as Special Assistant to the President for Global Affairs, National Coordinator for Security and Counterterrorism, and Special Advisor to the President for Cyberspace. The author of 8 books, including the New York Times number one bestseller, Against All Enemies, Inside America's War on Terror. His most recent book is Warnings, Finding Cassandras to Prevent Catastrophes. And he is the host of the new podcast, Future State. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.